On Capitol Hill today, German Chancellor Angela Merkel spoke to Congress, the first such address by a German leader in more than 50 years. Merkel also met with President Obama, all in advance of next week's 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And that occasion inspired our senior news analyst, Daniel Schorr.
I'm generally not much on historic anniversaries, but this one is special. 20 years ago, the Berlin Wall was breached. That marked the beginning of the end of the Soviet Empire. And today, Angela Merkel, who grew up in East Germany, behind the wall, spoke for a united Germany in Washington. At dawn on a Sunday morning in August 1961, I witnessed the VOPOs, the East German police, unrolling bales of barbed wire, soon to be replaced by concrete blocks that turned East Berlin into a prison. 28 years the wall lasted, while other parts of the Soviet realm, Hungary, Poland, Czechoslovakia, became unstuck. President Kennedy came to West Berlin in 1963 to denounce the wall. President Reagan in 1987 came to issue a challenge. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. On November 9, 1989, the East German authorities, trying to ease the pressure, opened up several checkpoints for visits. Too late. East Berliners, first by the dozens and soon by the thousands, streamed through the opening in the wall. Gorbachev told the East German authorities not to expect any military help from the Soviets. Soon, Berliners were dancing on top of the wall and breaking off pieces of the wall, sometimes with their bare hands. In retrospect, that marked the beginning of the end of the empire that Lenin and Stalin had created. It was not long before East Germany was welcomed back into a unified state, trying to learn democratic ways. And Angela Merkel, who had shunned politics as a doctor of physics, joined a burgeoning democratic movement on her way to the chancellorship. There are other physical walls today, the one between the Israelis and the Palestinians, for example. But a wall can mean not only closed borders, but closed minds. In Iran today, strict suppression of dissent is met by the technology of freedom, the Internet, which breaks down walls. It remains true, as the poet Robert Frost wrote, "Something there is that doesn't love a wall." This is Daniel Schorr.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
These are hard times for fish lovers and for fish. Yesterday on our show, marine ecologist Daniel Pauly warned us about how industrial fishing, with the help of trawls as large as 6 jumbo jets, is depleting stocks of fish and changing the ecosystems of the oceans. As areas get fished out, industry boats move to deeper waters and more remote areas. Pauly says we're now at the last frontier of fishing, although not all experts are as pessimistic. Today we're going to hear his suggestions about what fish to eat, which fish have the highest mercury content, and what about farmed fish. Pauly is a professor at the Fishery Center of the University of British Columbia and principal investigator of its Sea Around Us project. Let's start with his suggestions about how to prevent more fish stock from being depleted. He opposes subsidizing fisheries because, in his opinion, this can be an incentive to continue overfishing. And he supports creating areas where the stock can recover and replenish themselves, marine protected areas or sanctuaries.
The U.S. actually is doing this. In California, there is a system of marine protected areas. Parts of Alaska also are not going to be exploited. And so that is very positive measures. And in Hawaii, the northwestern Hawaiian island, their stocks of fish can recover and repopulate the areas that are being fished. The scientists tell you how much can be fished in a certain area. Listen to them. In most fisheries, once the scientists have said 10,000 tons can be fished there, the politicians say, oh, we have to have 20,000 tons exploited because of social consideration. And this results in 1 year or 2 years of happiness, so to say. But after that, the stock goes. And then it costs even more to maintain the fisheries that are being helped that way.
I love fish, and you're painting a very grim picture of our fish future. Let's talk about eating fish. You complain in your article that we continue to eat fish as if it were a sustainable practice. And you say eating a tuna roll at a sushi restaurant should be considered no more environmentally benign than driving a Hummer or harpooning a manatee. So are you saying we shouldn't be eating fish, or we shouldn't be eating certain fish, or shouldn't be eating as much fish?
There is a big debate about that. And I'm not sure what I should answer. Because on one hand, I very much sympathize with the notion that we should regulate our consumption to reflect our values. That's one thing. On the other hand, no fishery has ever been managed based on consumption patterns. They get reasonably managed when the government intervenes and say, you should catch so much, and we're going to have a surveillance program. We're going to have a observer on board to make sure that you do the things that you said you would do. Without compliance and surveillance program, you cannot regulate fisheries. And I have problems linking the good intention of consumers with the surveillance programs.
So in other words, good intentions of consumers, if I eat less fish, it's not going to stop the fisheries from continuing to fish out.
That's the question fish. I have. This is like I separate the paper from other garbage, and I do all the good things, and I drive a Prius, but I don't fool myself that this is going to... It's my contribution to global warming. This is a big problem. It can be addressed by big powers, and a big power is the government. I think that we must act as citizens and not only as consumers.
As consumers, I'll speak about myself here. I mean, I eat a lot of fish, and I love, like, salmon and flounder and tilapia.
So do I.
Yeah, catfish is really good. And do you prefer, as a consumer yourself, choosing one fish over another because of your knowledge of which fish are depleted?
Certainly. Mm-hmm. I live in British Columbia, and I eat wild-caught salmon as opposed to farm salmon. And
can I stop you there? Why is that? You know, I go to the store and I always figure, like, farmed salmon, well, they're not going to run out because they're going to be depleted because they're farmed. I mean, they're just restocking the supply
to produce one pound of salmon, you need 3 pounds of other fish that are ground up and fed to them. The food that they eat is made out of other fish that are ground up. And these fish are perfectly edible. They are anchovies, sardine, herrings, and mackerels, and so on, that are caught elsewhere. That's the first reason that people are not aware about farming. Fish farming cannot produce fish when it produces the equivalent of lions that need to be fed gazelles to produce the bodies. Fish farming is not producing fish. It's consuming fish. At least when it is the farming of carnivorous fish, or fish that eat other fish. On the other hand, when you eat a catfish, catfish are fed soy meal. Soy meal is a vegetable matter, and you end up with a net fish production, but not with salmon.
So farmed catfish, are eating that is better environmentally? Because you're killing fewer fish.
Yep.
What about tilapia?
Tilapia are herbivorous animals also. They consume algae, and to the extent that they're not fed with fish meal, as sometimes happens, tilapia are environmentally very friendly.
What other fish are environmentally friendly?
Mussels. If you will count the shellfish, all bivalves, all oysters, mussels, clams, and so on, are feeding at the bottom of the food web. They are good things.
Do you think about mercury when you eat fish?
Now, mercury comes from a consumption of fish on the top of food web, carnivores. And carnivores enrich the pollutants that accumulate in the bodies of their prey. And they are the worst accumulators of nasties, that dioxin and PCBs and mercury is one of them. And a dish like sushi or sashimi that in Japan was a festive dish that you ate from time to time has become something that some people eat regularly, even daily. And that is high risk, especially for pregnant women, for example.
Health-wise, are we better off eating smaller fish?
Yeah, certainly. The anchovies, for example, they are very tasty and they don't bioaccumulate the pollutant that we talked about. So both in terms of taste and in terms of health, eating small fish is better for you.
What other small fish should we be thinking about?
Well, herring, sardine, anchovies, for example. In fact, in Europe, if you go as a tourist or to Germany, you will have Matthias herring in various forms. Or in Spain and Portugal, you will have all kind of sardine. And these fish are excellent.
When you eat sardines, are they in a can or are they fresh?
They can be in a can. They can be fresh. They can be grilled. In Spain, they eat a lot of grilled sardine.
Daniel Pauly, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Daniel Pauly is a professor at the Fishery Center of the University of British Columbia and principal investigator of its Sea Around Us project.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Over the past couple of years, as the foreclosure crisis has grown, NPR has been following the efforts of a pretty colorful housing advocate. His name is Bruce Marks, and he heads up the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, NACA. As NPR's Chris Arnold reports, lately Marks has been on tour, where he says he's helped bring down loan payments for nearly 100,000 homeowners.
Bruce Marks only half-jokingly calls himself a non-violent bank terrorist. Back last winter, we did a story on Marks when he led several hundred people down the driveway and up to the mansion of a house where John Mack lives. Mack is the CEO of Morgan Stanley.
It's so outrageous. While Americans are losing their homes by the millions, he's living here in his beautiful house.
Marks has protested plenty of other executives who he says are not doing enough to avoid foreclosures. He's even posted on his website their photos and home phone numbers. Morgan Stanley said it's working with Marks's group. And for Marks, it's not just about the bullhorns. For 20 years, he's run a nonprofit that makes affordable home loans. And over the past year, he's doubled his staff and now has 1,200 employees nationwide.
If you have any questions, please feel free to locate your team.
We caught up with Marks at a very different sort of event in San Francisco. Lately, Marks has been running a foreclosure help roadshow. He calls it the Save the Dream Tour. His group, NACA, rents out a stadium for several days, and a ton of people show up.
In Los Angeles, we had over 50,000 people there. Then in Phoenix, over 40,000 people. Vegas, over 45,000 people.
Housing counselors are set up at hundreds of tables across the floor of the stadium. Homeowners are told to bring their loan documents, W-2s, and other paperwork. Through his protests, Marks has pressured many of the major banks and other so-called loan servicing companies to sign agreements to work with him, and so they send representatives here too. And Marks says over the past year, his group's been able to renegotiate loans and get payments lowered for more than 90,000 homeowners.
I was in Las Vegas last weekend, and I finished up here today.
62-year-old Bernice Jackson is from Los Angeles. She drove hundreds of miles to come to these events. Jackson's husband is retired, and they're on a fixed income. She says a mortgage broker lied to them, and she got into a loan that she just couldn't afford.
Oh, man, I had a very high interest rate, and through NACA and the help of the servicers, I got the note reduced to 2%. So my note went from almost $4,000 a month to $1,600 a month. Yes, I'm very excited, very happy.
Now, that may sound too good to be true, but Marx's group pushes the banks to try to get a new payment that the homeowner can really afford. And that can make sense for the banks or the investors who own the loans. And actually, a very big-time investor has shown up here at this event.
Yeah, it's actually pretty unbelievable. Want to come see what they're doing and how they're doing it, and it's pretty impressive.
Scott Simon is a managing director for PIMCO. It's an investment firm that manages some $200 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities. That makes him one of the biggest mortgage investors in the entire world. And here he is, standing in the midst of thousands of people looking to pay investors like him less money, and he thinks that's a good idea. In fact, he'd actually like to see more people getting their principal reduced. That's the amount that they owe. He says that too many people are upside down, owing way more than their house is worth, and that doesn't give them much of an incentive to keep their house.
Well, I think that is right, because you're going to potentially have as many as 7 million people go into foreclosure unless they're helped over the next 3 years. So, you know, you're talking about 10% of households. You know, foreclosure is almost always the absolute worst thing can happen. It's bad for the homeowner. It's bad for the neighborhood. It's bad for the investors. It's bad for the system.
Simon would like to see more workouts where investors like him forgive a chunk of principal so that the loan can be refinanced at a market rate and the borrower isn't upside down anymore. Other investors have resisted these efforts. They think too many homeowners won't make even the lower payments, so they'll get foreclosed on anyway. But Bruce Marks estimates that about 75% of the homeowners that NACA gets a loan modification for keep making their payments. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
The president is also likely to be judged on whether he can successfully overhaul health care. That emotional and divisive debate becomes even more so because of abortion. Opponents of abortion say they will try to block the House bill from reaching the floor for a vote if the current language on abortion is not made more restrictive. In the middle of this battle is the Catholic Church. It strongly opposes abortion, but also strongly supports a health overhaul, NPR's Julie Rodner reports.
The desire to make health care a basic human right is hardly a new position for the Catholic Church.
I think in our files we have a letter from the bishops to Harry Truman urging comprehensive health care reform.
Richard Dorflinger is with the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. At the same time, he points out, the Church doesn't just advocate for health care, it's also one of the nation's major providers of health care.
Our Catholic Charities and Catholic Hospital outlets take care of millions of people. I think it's been estimated that 1/6 of the people who go into a hospital every year are going into a Catholic hospital.
But so far, the Church hasn't been able to support either the House or Senate versions of the health overhaul bills now being readied for floor votes because of their abortion language, Dorflinger says.
We want health care reform very, very much. But we cannot do that over children's dead bodies, to put it most bluntly, but there is a fundamental issue here about whether taking life should be treated the same way as supporting and healing life.
But abortion rights supporters say the bills don't actually expand access to abortion, and they wish it would. Nancy Northup is president of the Center for Reproductive Rights.
This is not at all what the reproductive rights movement had hoped for in health care reform, and it's not a win for women. It's a compromise.
Originally, says Northup, she and other pro-choice leaders wanted to see abortion covered like any other women's health service.
About 1 in 3 women in the United States has an abortion in her lifetime, and it should be part of her reproductive health care.
But it was quickly clear that wasn't going to happen. What lawmakers decided instead was to try to craft what they called abortion-neutral language. In other words, to try to freeze in place the status quo. Currently, the federal government doesn't pay for abortion in most cases, but many, if not most, private insurance plans do. Abortion foes, however, say the language included in the bills is not neutral and favors the abortion rights side. Douglas Johnson is federal legislative director for the National Right to Life Committee. His side has two big problems. He says the new government-run public plan could end up offering abortion as a benefit, and that the federal government would provide subsidies to private insurance plans that pay for abortion.
Both of these things would be sharp departures from decades of federal abortion policy, and so we want to apply the long-standing principles of federal law to these new programs, which would mean that the monies could not be used to support elective abortions or coverage for elective abortion.
Backers of the language currently in the bill say Johnson is overstating the case. that the federal government would be prohibited from directly funding abortion and that money for private insurance subsidies would have to be kept separate if it's going to be used to cover abortion. But while that debate rages on Capitol Hill, another quieter debate is taking place within the Catholic Church. That's where John O'Brien, president of the group Catholics for Choice, says not everyone agrees with the hard line on abortion being taken by the bishops.
American Catholics, as you know, the polls show time and time again, disagree with the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops on the abortion issue. They believe in reproductive health care and see reproductive health care as a responsible part of health care.
O'Brien says most American Catholics see health overhaul as part of the church's social justice agenda, regardless of the abortion language in the bills. And it's not just abortion. The Catholic Church also wants a health overhaul bill to ensure access to health care for everyone in the country, including illegal immigrants. That's going to be another uphill fight. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
Before we leave tonight, we're going to make another visit to the Momofuku Noodle Bar in New York City. If we were actually visiting Momofuku and its standing room only annex called Milk Bar, we'd find two eateries that are small and loud with not much in the way of decor, and there's always a long line of customers out the door. And when those patrons finally step up to bark out their noodle orders, most also ask for Momofuku's famous pork buns. David Chang is owner of Momofuku and author of the new cookbook with the same name. Chang says his pork bun works because of its complex mix of flavors and textures.
It's soft, it's unctuous, it has a burst of fat flavor from the salty pork belly, and then it's got this cool, crunchy texture from the pickled cucumbers and the sweetness from the hoisin sauce. So I didn't anticipate it ever being as wildly successful as it is, but they're sort of addictive. They just are salty, sweet, and sandwiched between a soft, pillowy, steamed bread.
You say you're surprised by their success.
Yeah, people don't believe me when I say they were 11th hour addition. I had, in the book, it describes me on the hunt of the recipe of making steamed buns. People don't think that bread is part of Asian culture or Asian food culture, but it's quite prevalent in northern China, and you see it throughout Japan and as you go to Taiwan. And I hadn't seen it in this form until I went to a restaurant called Oriental Garden, and that became an obsession. I would always ask the owner there, I call him Uncle Choi, I was like, you have to give me this recipe. And I essentially went there every day bothering him and badgering him until he told me that he doesn't even make these things.
You know, I'm wondering if maybe you should just read your description of the search for the bread, because the description of the book is just so delicious. If you have the book.
I do. There's sort of an esoteric reference to a movie, I think, that was produced by Quincy Jones. Have you ever seen the blaxploitation martial arts movie, The Last Dragon, from the 80s, where the dude is in constant search for some type of master who can provide some wisdom? And in the end, it turns out to be a hoax. The master's place is a fortune cookie factory. That's how I felt when the place I was sent to learn the secret of steamed bread turned out to be Mei Mei Foods, a local company that supplied dozens of New York restaurants with pre-made dim sum items, including the buns. Before it closed in 2007, the guy there, John, showed me the dead simple process. A little mixing, a little steaming, and presto, buns. It turns out they are made from a simple white bread dough. Mantou, the Chinese name, is not so different from, say, Wonder Bread. That is steamed instead of baked. So when we started making it ourselves, we started to develop our own recipe and our own essentially white bread. And next time you make a loaf of bread, don't bake it. Pop it in the steamer and
like a bamboo steamer?
Yeah, bamboo steamer would work. Line it with a little oil on the bottom so the bread doesn't stick and see what happens.
Your book includes a recipe for the steamed bun. It's a huge recipe. It makes 50 buns.
Well,
it seems
not
like a lot.
It seems like a lot, but I guarantee you, if you make it for a party of six, they're going to be all gone.
Oh, so maybe 50 is not enough.
Well, it is. I've seen people eat like eight, and if this was for a party, it would be a perfect canapé, and especially if you make the bread, you can make them into a smaller size, so they're literally one-bite things, like a White Castle burger almost.
So you say you take the bun, you slather on some hoisin sauce.
Yeah.
You use some of the pickled cucumbers.
Cucumbers, yeah. It's essentially a riff on the Peking duck.
Uh-huh.
It's delicious. It's fatty. It's all the things that I think people, they don't want the calorie intake. They don't want to know that stuff. But
I was going to ask, is there a healthier alternative here? I mean, if you try to do steam buns with
you can certainly do chicken
or something with that.
No. You can make vegetable buns. We make shiitake buns. The fillings are endless. But for me, the biggest surprise why it became so popular was I didn't anticipate New Yorkers embracing pork belly as much as they did. Because I guess a decade ago or even in the late 1990s, restaurants couldn't sell a dish called pork belly. So people would change it to called fresh bacon. And I refused to call it fresh bacon buns. I was like, we're going to call it what it is, pork belly. And to my surprise, people embraced it.
David Chang, he's the chef and co-author of the cookbook Momofuku. It's named after his New York noodle restaurant.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
As we approach the holiday shopping season, we're reporting on the doll business, which is a rough business. The toy maker Mattel vanquished a major competitor to its Barbie dolls in a copyright lawsuit. The popular Bratz dolls will soon disappear from store shelves. But another version of those dolls is now on the shelf and is providing fresh competition for Mattel's new line of Fashionista Barbies. To find out more, we called Ann Zimmerman. She covers the toy industry for The Wall Street Journal.
The folks that built Bratz were reeling after this lawsuit. They say they spent $100 million on it, but they came out swinging this summer with a new series of dolls called Moxie. They're not as suggestive as Bratz. You can dye their hair and wash it out, put glitter in it. Their clothes are sort of fun and funky. You can paint other accessories like their boots.
Let's listen to a moment, if we can, for some of the advertising for Moxie Girls with a Z.
It's okay to be kind of different and stand out. I call it Moxie. When I'm true to myself, I can do anything. Hey, I'm a Moxie girl.
Oh, that's so classic. It's okay to be different. Be like everybody else and buy this doll that makes it okay to be different.
Clever marketing, huh?
But not the only clever competition to Barbie here.
That's correct. A company known mostly for hits in the boy world, a company called Spin Master, came out this summer with something called Live Dolls. They're four friends that are supposedly sort of regular teenagers. They have interchangeable wigs.
The interchangeable wig seems like a big deal because that means your kid can cut the doll's hair and destroy it in any number of ways, and it's not permanently ruined.
You have daughters, don't you?
Yes, I have a daughter.
Yes, you can destroy and get more. And girls love that. But the key to Live Dolls are that they each have, they're sort of more like ordinary teenagers. Barbie's a little bit perfect and untouchable. These dolls, they have backstories. One is a wannabe rock star, but she's still cutting her teeth doing gigs at the retirement home. so it's kind of more like...
I know some 40-somethings that would fit into one of those categories, but that's not important right now. Go ahead.
And these backstories are developed every day on the internet, which is an important part of toy manufacturing today. As you can imagine, if you feel like you're losing your audience to the internet, why not try to build in some features there to try to keep them in your toy or game longer?
So who's winning here in this battle among Barbie and some other dolls?
Well, the analysts think that Liv and Moxie have an edge because they came out earlier. They were on the shelves this summer before school started, and you know how powerful a marketing tool your neighborhood school playground can be. But, you know, Barbie's a really big brand beyond the Fashionista dolls. I mean, it's got a lot of muscle behind it.
Ann Zimmerman, one other question. This is a multi-billion dollar business, right, among dolls?
That's correct.
As you have covered this very serious business story, I'm just curious, are there occasions when you just kind of close the office door with all those dolls that you've had to collect for your job and you just play?
Between you and me?
I do. Ann Zimmerman of The Wall Street Journal, thanks very much.
Thank you.